This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is the Daily Digest on the Bigger Picture with me, T. Xiao Yik, Juliet Jacobs and Sumitra Selvaraj. As always, we have two stories for you today.
Yes, and in our first story, one of the most threatened yet overlooked ecosystems on Earth, seagrass could have a promising future thanks to its ability to absorb carbon. So we are going to investigate what is called the ugly duckling of marine conservation.
Oh. Very sad, poor thing.
It's not ugly at all. It's beautiful.
Yeah. So it was around 100 million years ago, grass from land actually adapted to live and reproduce while submerged in seawater. So that's our modern day seagrasses. Mm-hmm. And just like grasses on land, seagrasses form vast meadows. They produce flowers and seeds and are home to an incredibly diverse community of organisms. And although they get little attention, as we said earlier, seagrasses are a vital part of the marine ecosystem. They are one of the most threatened yet overlooked ecosystems on Earth. But the humble seagrass could have a promising future thanks to its ability to absorb carbon, as we will explore a bit later.
So seagrass has a range of benefits. They act as a nursery and food source for a wide variety of marine life. They provide a home for many fish and charismatic animals, just turtles and dugongs, which I love, by the way. Mm-hmm. They protect coastlines by absorbing wave energy, and they also produce oxygen and clean the ocean by soaking up polluting nutrients produced on land by humans, of course.
So we are the cause of all the problems.
It's our fault.
So back in 2015, we spoke to Dr. Gillian Uy, a marine biologist and senior lecturer from the Department of Geography, Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Malaya, who's done a lot of research on seagrasses. Here she is giving us a 101 on seagrasses, describing how some assume seaweed and seagrass are the same thing. And she also shares where seagrass can be found.
But seagrass and seaweed are really different. Seaweed are really primitive plants. And in fact, the green seaweed are supposed to have been the ancestors of land plants. So, you know, if you believe in a theory of evolution, if you believe that all life comes from the sea, then basically a green seaweed decided to crawl up onto land one day, putting it in a very simple way. And this eventually evolved into terrestrial flowering plants. But then one special group of plants, which we call the seagrasses today, decided to do a U-turn. They decided that I'm not having any of this land-based stuff. So they basically went back, retreated back into the sea. That's what we call the seagrasses today. So that happened about 70 to 100 million years ago. They occur on every continent except Antarctica. In Malaysia, they occur mainly off the east coast of Peninsular Malaysia. And there's some, but very little. They've been actually declining on the west coast of Peninsular Malaysia because there's just so much more coastal development happening on the west coast. So it's a little bit harder for them to survive these days. But actually, the most beautiful intertidal meadow that Malaysians would have been able to look at would be when they cross between Malaysia, Johor and Singapore, you know, that bridge over there. And that's the most amazing intertidal meadow that's exposed at the lowest low tide. So you can actually walk out on it. And at other times, it's completely submerged. And it's beautiful, green as far as your eyes can see. You see dugong feeding trails everywhere, all manners of mollusks, you know, and sea cucumbers. Gorgeous. So that's the most accessible seagrass meadow, I would think.
Isn't that such a beautiful image?
Yes, yes. You know, makes you want to go to Singapore, yeah, just for that.
Or at least, you know, enjoy that horrible journey to get there. You know, with the traffic jam is what, yes, I mean. But seagrass also serves as its own unique habitat and is a diverse food web. So here's Gillian again explaining more on that.
They serve as their own habitat, as in seagrasses aren't just the plants or the species themselves, but they form a continuous habitat, much like coral reefs and mangroves. So they're really continuous, and all sorts of juvenile fish and crustaceans actually get attracted to seagrasses because they find it very easy to escape predators there when they're small in size. So you have an entire food web that builds up there. And they're actually seagrasses because, you know, their leaves kind of break off after a little while and float away. So they're very good for filter feeders. So that's why you have a lot of shellfish there. It's very rich and abundant with shellfish. So their habitat for that as well. And that's what the concept all means. They are a habitat in and of themselves, as well as they provide habitat for so many other marine organisms as well.
She's so eloquent and passionate about seagrass that I'm beginning to thaw towards the idea of seagrass. I've got to admit, I first thought that seagrass and seaweed, you know, the thing that wraps around your ankle. Oh, no, my God. But you know what? She paints, as you said, Juliet, such a beautiful picture. And thanks to you, I've learned that seagrass accounts for 10% of the ocean's capacity to store carbon, so-called blue carbon, despite occupying only 0.2% of the seafloor. That's impressive. And it can capture carbon from the atmosphere up to 35 times faster than tropical rainforests. They are known as the lungs of the ocean. And here's Gillian explaining why they have been given this name and how they store this so-called blue carbon.
Well, because they are able to produce so much fresh oxygen. I mean, one square meter of seagrass is supposed to be able to produce at least 10 liters of fresh oxygen in a day. So that keeps the water aerated and that keeps the sediment aerated as well, because seagrasses grow in sediment that can get rather anoxic. That means they can get rather devoid of oxygen, which is bad overall. You know, it smells bad, it looks bad, it looks black and gunky. But the seagrasses are able to keep that aerated just through oxygen production. And that helps all the other marine worms and crabs and crustaceans that can burrow in there and live as well. So it's not just things that live above the substrate on the seagrass, but underground as well. So the seagrasses are maintaining a very productive environment for them. Some of my colleagues in Australia have been looking at carbon sequestration, or they call it blue carbon. So whatever carbon that's stored by seagrass, by mangroves, by swamps, coastal swamps actually. And they found that it's comparable to the rates captured by tropical rainforests, for instance. So I can't remember the value, but I think it's about 27 billion tons a year or something like that. But it's a huge amount. And basically, my colleagues in Australia were concerned that if we were to destroy all this, it means that we would be releasing up to 10 to 12% of carbon into the atmosphere. So that's a lot of carbon entering our atmosphere and contributing to the change in climate.
So according to the Ocean as a Solution to Climate Change, Five Opportunities for Action, a report that was published by the World Resources Institute, while the mitigation potential per unit area of restoring seagrasses is relatively high, though of course not as high as for restoring salt marshes or mangroves, the mitigation potential of seagrass conservation is exceptionally high and much higher than that of salt marshes and mangroves. However, it's important to understand that there are many unknowns with seagrass. So another report titled Assessing the Capacity of Seagrass Meadows for Carbon Burial. Very long title, sorry. And Current Limitations and Future Strategies. It noted that data on the regional cover and carbon stocks in seagrass meadows is sparse for some regions, particularly the Indo-Pacific, Africa, and also South America.
And in addition to that, the report adds that understanding of the factors regulating the variability in carbon sink capacity among seagrass meadows, is still limited. We don't know enough yet. And these gaps limit the capacity to formulate proper strategies to be able to mitigate climate change based on the carbon sink capacity of seagrass meadows. But, you know, restoration of these habitats can count towards national climate change plans. And each signatory to the Paris Agreement is required to submit its plan or their nationally determined contributions, NDCs, to the United Nations, with successive plans becoming more ambitious.
And the potential for seagrass in nationally determined contributions is pretty significant. As some 159 countries have seagrass on their shores. And an analysis soon to be published by Grit Arendal, a Norwegian foundation working with the United Nations Environment Programme, found that 10 countries have already included seagrass in existing nationally determined contributions. Five countries refer to its conservation and restoration in mitigation actions, while eight do plan to use it in adaptation for the future.
But, you know, seagrass meadows are, as we know, they're also rapidly disappearing in many parts of the world. And according to research by, academics at the James Cook University in Australia. So the impact of the 1 billion or more people who live within 50 kilometres of them are largely to blame. Again, it's the people. But that's also including damage from coastal development and degraded water quality from nutrient pollution.
So again, us.
Again, us, yes. And annual rates of decline have accelerated from about 0.9% before 1940 to 7% since 1990, with loss rates comparable to those of coral reefs and tropical rainforests. So, I mean, just to get an idea of, you know, the kind of species who are threatened by the loss of seagrass and, you know, whether seagrasses, once compromised, can be easily rehabilitated, we hear again from Gillian on that.
Well, dugongs. I guess I should talk about our charismatic fauna now. The seahorses, you know, those are all our flagship species. Green turtles, because they feed almost exclusively on seagrass, as well as dugongs, also rely heavily on seagrass meadows. So these three would really be in a lot of trouble. And the dugong and the turtle, for example, they're threatened species. They're on the IUCN red list. Now that we see a lot of decline happening, seagrasses are going to be hit by attempts to restore them or to transplant them in the same way that coral reefs also over here. You know, you get a lot of artificial reefs and reef propagation going on. In Australia, as well as in Florida, in the US, where many years of transplantation and seagrass restoration efforts have been going on, they've been successful to a certain degree, but it takes a lot of money and effort. And maybe it's actually cheaper to protect the seagrasses rather than to try to restore them or to try to rehabilitate them. To transplant seagrasses, basically you need to either throw out a lot of seeds, you know, and hope that they regenerate, which is very difficult to do, or you need to individually take shoots and go send divers down to plug them in, which is very, very expensive. And you won't even be sure about the success rate, because with some of my colleagues in Australia, the moment they plant in a little seagrass shoot, crabs would come up and snip them off because they'll be like, oh yeah, food for me, thank you, mate. You know, so it's not easy, but I think it's something that we have to think about in the future, considering that we have a lot of land reclamation work happening.
Sadly, though, policymakers have been slow to realise the many benefits of seagrass, and blue carbon has mostly been focused on mangroves. They are after all, they are the easiest ecosystem to get through. They are visible, so you know where they are. And Stephen Lutz, the blue carbon program leader at Grit Arundel, said that, you know, quote, seagrass is out of sight, out of mind.
Oh dear. But there is hope on the horizon. The potential of seagrasses to sequester carbon is now starting to gain international attention as efforts to tackle the climate emergency become even more urgent. The latest report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, focusing on oceans and the cryosphere, points out that the mangroves, salt marshes and seagrass meadows can store up to 1,000 tonnes of carbon per hectare. That's far, far higher than most terrestrial ecosystems.
It's crazy, right? And countries like United States and Sweden have been experimenting with seagrass restoration for several years, and a team in the UK is about to embark on the largest seagrass restoration project ever undertaken in its waters.
But, you know, as Gillian alluded to earlier, you know, restoration is tricky, it's expensive, and evidence suggests that the bigger the project is, the more chance there is of success. So if the project is too small, it's very susceptible to damage and, you know, crabs coming and eating.
Yes. I was just going to say, you don't want to fight with those crabs, man.
So UNEP and the Nairobi Convention, they will actually be launching a manual on seagrass restoration for the Western Indian Ocean in the near future. But I think it's safe to say that humans, you know, we don't really have the long-term experience of planting at sea as, you know, opposed to how our many centuries of experience on land. So again, wherever possible, it's better just to conserve what we already have, just as Gillian said.
Yeah. And also, I think a couple of weeks ago, I did this story on the Daily Digest about scientists who've sort of found the link between what happened during the large mass extinction that wiped out a lot of dinosaurs and, you know, like 70% of all land on Earth, right? Of all life on Earth. And they found the link was ocean acidification.
Right.
And so, you know, it seems to me that if we are experiencing ocean acidification again today due to rising carbon emissions, it's all the more imperative. I mean, we are headed towards extinction, aren't we?
We are. And again, we're just not learning from history. I think it was what we discussed, right? We're just refusing to listen to the facts.
And on that cheerful note...
It's always cheer on this show.
On that cheerful note, we'll be looking at Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey's strange morning habit in our second story.
I think some people are going to take offense that you called it strange.
Yes. Well, we will leave it to the expert to dissect it for us. So stay tuned for that conversation. But first, here's Echo and the Bunnymen with Seven Seas, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.